radio station, KBOO-FM. I'm Cecil Prescott, and make a good day.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dot.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right
there. That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
Hey KBOO listeners, KBOO cut through the clouds during our end-of-year campaign thanks to support from listeners like you. When we meet our campaign goals, we can continue to bring you colorful, radiant rays of radio. Thank you, and keep tuning in for unique music, cutting-edge news, and transformative public affairs on the airwaves.
Hi, I'm Cory Doctorow, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. I'm Norm Diamond, your host. Patricia Colbert is our engineer and producer. We call KBOO Community Powered because it's based in and geared toward both representing and creating our community here in Oregon. KBOO is a big part of what's made this area unique in the country, politically and culturally. I'm glad you're listening. I hope you, like we, are a supporter of the station. Today is the last Old Mole of January, so I want to acknowledge that it's 30 years ago this month that an uprising in the mountains of southern Mexico set off a worldwide movement against the economic structures that dominate our lives today. We call those structures neoliberal capitalism, and they're based on dispossessing people of their land and resources, annihilating cultures, extractivism, state repression, and absorbing all peoples everywhere into the racist, exploitive system we too live under and fight to transform. The same day the infamous NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, went into effect, this coalition of indigenous peoples forcefully rejected it and the damage to their communities it aimed to impose. So, a salute to the Zapatistas, the Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional, for 30 years of inspiration in the struggle we share. This morning's program takes us both around the world and back in history, and up to our own present-day Portland. We go from a historical alternative to Zionism, which existed among the Jewish working class in Europe, to the consequences of colonialism as depicted in Arab cinema, from race relations in a small town in Pennsylvania to the small group of rich folks who dominate Portland politics. To get us in the mood to hear about the plutocrats who run Portland, here's a tune you might recognize. That, of course, was the Beatles, suggesting love has to take second place to money. You might have seen billboards around town, or even received emails from a group calling itself People for Portland. Our first piece suggests that group might more appropriately be named Plutocrats for Portland. What's a plutocrat? Someone who's politically powerful because they are rich. My dictionary lists as possible synonyms oppressor and dictator. Hyung Nam has been stalwart for decades in resisting the Portland plutocrats. He's an organizer with the Portland Metro People's Coalition. Here, he tells us what's really going on behind the smoke and mirrors. Hyung?
Between mainstream news and local billboards lately, you might think that downtown Portland is a free fire zone occupied only by syringe-wielding homicidal litter bugs, and that everyone but you wants more police, more sweeps, and fewer environmental regulations. Over and over, stories suggest that all our hard-won progressive reforms were mistaken and we must change course, but none of this is true. It is true that downtown has changed, but not because of things peculiar to Portland. The changes largely result from the global pandemic and the shift to remote work. As John Rennie Short explained recently in The Conversation, downtown development all over the U.S. had been inflated by Reagan-era tax policies and low interest rates, and COVID helped burst the 40-year bubble. So why all the panic about downtown Portland? Let's review. As part of massive nationwide historic protests in 2020, Portlanders demanded the city reduce police budgets and redirect funds to Portland street response and unarmed response to non-life-threatening mental health and behavioral issues. Oregonians passed Measure 110 to decriminalize drugs and align the response to addiction with professional best practices. County voters elected a progressive district attorney who called for police accountability and rethinking of public safety. Portlanders also worked for housing justice, passing relocation assistance for renters and voting in 2018 Metro Housing Bond and 2020 Metro Supportive Housing Services Measure. And after a long process with extensive community engagement, Portland voters approved a new city charter. Portlanders pushed for these changes in a city that already lacked affordable housing and access to drug treatment and was out of compliance with the Federal Department of Justice consent decree over police repeatedly violating residents' civil rights. People in Portland were responding to ongoing police brutality, to some of the nation's worst racial disparities in arrests, and to data that showed that the majority of arrests in Portland targeted unhoused people for low-level offenses, not even crimes, resulting in costly police, courts, jails, and even prison sentences. These experiences further traumatize unhoused people and make it even more difficult for them to become housed. And the Ninth Circuit Court in Boise ruled that it was unconstitutional to sweep and arrest unhoused people when there were not enough shelters available for them. Despite the housing crisis, real estate developers fought against inclusionary zoning and many other housing reforms. Developers are major players in Portland Business Alliance, recently rebranded as the Portland Metro Chamber. The PBA is the most powerful lobby in city politics, has repeatedly violated lobbying rules, and spends large amounts on local elections. grassroots efforts have resisted the onslaught of business influence, passing county and city ballot measures to limit money in local elections, despite a challenge from the PBA, the Portland Metropolitan Association of Realtors, and Associated Oregon Industries. Since the plutocrats can no longer buy elections so easily, they created new advocacy organizations, including the dark money group People for Portland. People for Portland has spent millions in creating a narrative about Portland, push-polling, generating emails to city leaders, lobbying, funding multiple PACs, and pushing to criminalize unhoused people while partially causing the housing crisis as they gentrify the city for profit. In 2022, People for Portland, the Everyone Deserves Safe Shelter PAC, and donors like the real estate firm Killian Pacific spent tens of thousands of dollars and were ready to spend hundreds of thousands more to redirect Metro Supportive Housing Services tax dollars to emergency shelter beds instead of actual housing. These plutocrats keep attempting to move us away from proven solutions like Housing First towards costly sweeps and temporary mass shelters. The city council collaborated by awarding a $50 million contract to Urban Alchemy to manage encampments that will get around the Boise ruling and remove homeless Portlanders from public spaces. Now the PBA and their politicians are seeking more state funding for corrections and trying to undermine the new city charter so rich lobbyists can maintain control. The push for police and sweeps is not just ideologically based. Landowners and developers have a stake in trying to, quote-unquote, revitalize downtown. Notably, they have an interest in capitalizing on Trump's 2017 Opportunity Zone tax breaks. As David Wessel explains in his book, Only the Rich Can Play, Opportunity Zones provide tax breaks on long-term investments in certain low-income census tracts, although because census tracts are often quite large, wealthy areas like the South Waterfront and the Pearl District can be included in tracts that count as overall low-income. Wessel adds, through the program, the rich can invest capital gains into qualified opportunity fund and postpone capital gains taxes, or if they hold the property for 10 years, pay no taxes on it at all. Oregon has 86 opportunity zones, including 31 in Portland. A cluster of them blanket the inner city. These opportunity zones allow the wealthy to evade taxes in the name of development. Take the Goodman family. Funders of PBA and People for Portland, the Goodmans are the largest downtown property owners. Through the Downtown Development Group and about a dozen obscure LLCs, they control 25 sites in opportunity zones, including the land the luxury Ritz-Carlton Hotel was built on. Terrified that unhoused people or anything else that hinders gentrification will limit their returns on investment, Portland's plutocrats push for more police to sweep, quote-unquote, undesirable people into jails or mass shelters that critics have called concentration camps. These vested interests have not only created an array of deceptively named advocacy groups, but have used their money and power to get the governor to create a special task force on downtown Portland. That agenda of wealthy property owners and developers has captured both the mayor in the Central City Plan and the governor in the new public-private partnership. Led by the PBA and their wealthy and powerful sponsors, the task force pushed their ideas about downtown, homelessness, and crime in meetings that were closed to the public and to journalists. And what has the task force called for? Limits and cuts to taxes, subsidies for businesses, and more cops, neglecting the root issues of housing unaffordability and lack of living wages, all to continue to make Portland a playground for the rich. Our new city charter means the next election will be historic. Portlanders must remember that everyone deserves housing, not carceral shelters, that equitably resourced cities don't need militarized policing, that we can't resuscitate a burst business bubble, but we can revitalize community action. Watch out for the fake People for Portland and support the real people of Portland. That's the rich! That's the rich!
Tax the rich, a forceful suggestion by The Craze. All our music today relates in one way or another to the commentary we just heard from Young Nam. Thanks to Old Mole Fran Michelle for her euphonious recommendations. Those of you who inspire to donate to Plutocrats for Portland, make out your checks to KABU. We'll make sure it goes to a good cause. Next on the Old Mole, I talk with the author of a new graphic history, an account in comic book form of an early alternative to Zionism that very unfortunately for the world today was wiped out by the Holocaust. Sharon Rudall is the author of The Bund. The Bund was a socialist organization among working-class European Jews with a vision of multi-ethnic, multi-religious peoples living harmoniously, not emigrating to Palestine, but fighting to improve everyone's lives where they already were living. Our guest this morning is Sharon Rudall. Sharon was with us, I suppose, about a year ago as the author and artist for a graphic biography of Paul Robeson. She's here today with a different book. Welcome, Sharon.
Thank you for having me, Norm.
I'm very glad to have you here. The book this time, the author of, not the artist, The Bund, a graphic history of Jewish labor resistance. The Bund, I will say one word and then turn it over to you. The Bund represented a working class Jewish movement in primarily in Eastern Europe that was an alternative to the colonization of Palestine. Tell us about the Bund.
So the Bund was trying to be the representative of Jewish workers within a greater struggle that would include many, many other workers of different ethnicities. They came very close to being, they were one of the two or three most influential groups up to the time that the Bolsheviks completely seized power over the coming revolution.
There are a bunch of questions. There are a bunch of issues to follow up on. But let's be very clear. You phrased something that I want to go back to. This was very explicitly a movement of Jewish workers, right?
Well, it was explicitly a movement for Jewish workers, not unlike the movements of my heyday in the late 60s, that many intellectuals and professionals and students amongst the Jews were the people that were actually carrying the tracks and bringing them into the factories and organizing the strikes and, you know, registering the supporters and so forth. It was a very familiar landscape. The actual people at the machines in the factories were not the ones that originated or directed the movement, but they were the ones that were organized by the Bund leaders. We go through the people that actually started it, and some of the main names tended to be more intellectuals. A woman representative was a dentist, and she would go into the factories where women worked and try to teach literacy to the women workers. But, you know, it wasn't the illiterate, as in every other revolution that I know of, it wasn't the illiterate masses that actually began the revolution. They were organized by other people who were later then viewed as enemies by the successful revolution. And this process continues to our day.
Now, the Bundists saw themselves as part of a larger movement at one point. You have a very interesting story to explain why they split. But at one point, they were part of the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, which included the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks, or the groups that became Mensheviks and Bolsheviks. So they were part of this broader coalition of working class oriented political groups. Why did they end up not part of that larger movement?
Well, one of the things that whenever I would try to get help from other older authors or just people that were interested in the Bund and had some sort of background on the Bund, there were certain issues that no one could agree on and that were real hot button issues that I just had to put aside and say, okay, I'm not going to be able to talk about that. And one of them was the word nation, because the nation calls up the idea of Israel and the Jewish nation. And there were such mixed feelings about that, even in the time of the Bund and later. So we didn't use the word nation. The Bund meetings that they would have every few years to argue about policy and come up with directives and decide who their allies were. Sometimes they said the Jews were a nation. Sometimes they said the Jews weren't a nation. But something to remember is there were dozens of groups of people, Ruthenians and, you know, people whose names you've never even heard of, who called themselves nations, who had their own languages, who had their own cultures that they wanted to preserve, who were working in order to get some sort of freedom for their groups within the Russian Empire, and then later to overturn the Russian Empire. Menshevik means minority, and Bolshevik means the majority. And maybe the third most powerful group shortly before the turn of the 20th century was the Jewish Bund. But Lenin was a very savvy tactician. I learned to appreciate his skills as a tactician more in doing research for this book than I had before. He wasn't just a charismatic leader of the people who stood up and gave great speeches. He really knew how to maneuver and how to manipulate. And he put an issue before a really important meeting. The Bund wanted to be recognized as the sole representative of Jewish workers. And Lenin put that first on the agenda to be voted on because he knew it would be voted down and that then the Bund would walk out of the meeting. And that's what occurred. And that's how the Mensheviks, the minority became the Mensheviks, and the Bolsheviks, the majority became the Bolsheviks. That's the origin story. It really made me appreciate Lenin as a tactician.
That is the story that I had in mind. Why though this insistence on being a discrete group just for Jewish workers?
Well, the language was a big issue, and the Bund, one of the big things about the Bund for people that supported it then and now is Yiddish. To more upper class Jews and to people that weren't Jews, Yiddish was just, you know, it was like a Creole. It was just a street language of lower class people. And even if all Jews spoke it and all Jews understood it in the northern part of the world, it still wasn't treated with any respect. But the Bund recognized that there was great poetry and theater and stories and life that took place in Yiddish, and that it wasn't, you know, an inferior version of some other language. Was a language unto itself. And Yiddish was a great part of the Bund ideal, and it's a part that survived. There's still Yiddish schools. Yiddish theater became Yiddish silent movies, which became, there's a lot about how Hollywood was actually the early movie industry, how much people who had grown up in the tradition of Yiddish theater and Bund thought were the people that helped create the early Hollywood movie system. So Yiddish, I personally don't know Yiddish. I have one comic I did in Yiddish here that, well, anyways, I can't show it to you because we're not doing it on screen. But it's not a language I know, but I recognize how an important part of Jewish culture it is. Because in moments of stress or moments of great anger, I find I know Yiddish I didn't know I knew just from hearing my parents speak and hearing my grandparents speak. It was the lingua franca of Jews. And the Bund people, the people that supported the Bund, they felt about Hebrew the way people would feel about Latin or Greek in 18th century Europe, that, you know, Hebrew was a language of the church, or it was the language of intellectuals, but it wasn't a language of people. It wasn't a language that you would organize demonstrations in or buy bread with or make jokes about your family with. And they wanted Yiddish to be respected as a true language. We still see arguments like that. I read just recently that, it's one of the Caribbean countries has decided to treat its own language as a language rather than as some inferior Creole that has to be replaced by English. So it was that kind of having respect for the language that people actually used and created art with was an important part of what the Bund was working with.
I have the impression that really we're talking about class struggles over language, that Yiddish was the language of this Jewish working class movement, and Hebrew, not so much of the Jewish workers.
Well, that's true, but there's more to it than that. Here we'll go back to my Paul Robeson research. Paul Robeson always talked like a very educated man of European descent, and he wanted the songs that Black people sung to be treated like European art songs. But apparently when he actually hung out with his friends after hours, he talked like a Black street person, and he told jokes that way. And that was the language that people actually understood and made them laugh and made them love and made them feel at home. Many people of all different backgrounds have a language like that. And Yiddish was that language for Jews. It was our language.
as an alternative to emigrating then and to advocating for moving to Palestine, what was the vision? This was to stay and fight for civil rights within
yes.
the empire?
Yes. And then later to, but also to just overcome, to ally with other groups. One group they allied with very often was the Polish socialists. They agreed with the Polish socialists about almost everything except how much more important Polish freedom was than anything else. And they could never really work that one out. But the Polish socialists would support the Jews even in street fighting. And they agreed with many of the same issues. The Polish people wanted autonomy too. These dozens and dozens of groups within the Russian Empire wanted autonomy. And while I was working on this, was just when Putin was in the process of trying to annex Ukraine again. So it really made it seem extremely timely and extremely important. This Russia wanting to be the center of gravity that sucked in all the peoples on its borders, and all the peoples on its borders wanting the right to their own. It wasn't just Jews and Christians. I mean, there were Muslim groups arsed on the borders of Russia that were being marginalized. And the Chechenian struggle is similar to the Jewish struggle in that way.
I wonder whether it is. Because Chechnya, the struggle was to have a separate land mass as a nation, whereas you described the struggle of the Bund not to have its own territory somehow, not to be its own country, but to be a distinct culture together with other cultures within a larger geographic entity.
That's a very interesting and good point you make. One of the things, again, this word nation, one of the things I was thinking when I was first learning about the Bund and getting ready to start writing the script was that I would have a title, would be something like Nation Without a Nation. It's a Jewish ideal that maybe is too high and dangerous an ideal to have lasted for very long or ever gain any more adherence, but it's a very noble ideal.
And one that, as you point out, was wiped out by the Nazis and, I guess, by the Soviets as well. You mentioned self-defense as one of the projects of the Bund. Were they part of a resistance to Nazism?
Yes. It was self-defense against pogroms in the period before fascism, but when fascism began to arose, there was self-defense and resistance. I think it's coming out more and more that the cliche of the meek Jews being herded into the ovens, that there were always partisans, there was always resistance, there was always active armed defense. And one of the chapters in my Bundbunks centers on a man, Bernard Goldstein, who had great connections to the underworld and used them to continue to get weapons into the Warsaw ghetto and get food and medicine into the Warsaw ghetto and finally escaped through the sewers and actually made it safely to the U.S. But, you know, there were continued to be resistance, and the Bund was instrumental in organizing it in areas in Europe. But, you know, it was defeated. It couldn't withstand. The people had nothing to fight with, you know, even with, except their minds, and it was hopeless, but they did continue to fight.
You mentioned earlier one woman who was in a leadership position. I want to ask about the role of women in general. In the graphic history that you've given us, women are depicted as leaders, as teachers, as smugglers of literature. That's what I remember from having read it. But I don't remember any particular statement in the book about a policy or position on the role of women.
I'm not sure whether I did explicitly say something. Again, it reminded me a lot of my heyday in the late 60s and even in the civil rights movement in its early days in the 50s, that it was an expectation that women would achieve literacy and that they would be able to undertake tasks that had previously been denied them. But the idea that they would actually be given parity with male leaders didn't occur to anybody until much later. I don't think it was any worse in the Bund in 1900 than it was in New York in 1965, but it's only very recently that women have actually said, hey, not only am I an effective revolutionary, I also don't want to make coffee for you guys anymore. That's a very recent development.
Okay, well, we'll leave it at that. That was actually not my experience in the 60s. There were strong women who were not reduced to making coffee, but I know the experience you're describing was pretty universal. I've been talking with Sharon Rudall, who is the author of The Bund, A Graphic History of Jewish Labor Resistance. And one last question for you, Sharon, and that is, the book is published by Between the Lines in Toronto, and they seem to have a slogan. It's new to me, but their slogan is Books Without Bosses. Who are they?
Well, I'm in my late 70s now, and I have to say I've washed up with a small left-wing publisher. They must get some funding from the Canadian government. They're a small, very principled, very intelligent left-wing publisher in Toronto, and they put forth projects that they think are worthwhile, even if they're not profitable. And they're going to be doing a book that I just finished a story about Josephine Baker for, about partisans in World War II. They'll have a lot of women, stories about women that have only come out in recent years, about just how much real fighting went on with women that weren't part of organized armies, but were fighting as partisans. So, Josephine Baker, for one, nobody knew what an actually effective secret agent she was until long after she died and the French government let some of the information out. There were a lot of things going on that we're just finding out about now. And I have to give BTL lots of credit for printing things like that. And there aren't too many people in the U.S. anymore that'll print things like that. Graphic novels and quote graphic stories, they get reviewed in the New York Times. They've only accepted if they're just as empty and philosophical and meaningless as the other kind of art and literature that gets reviewed in the New York Times. If they actually are full of belief and love and anger and something that'll make people get out in the streets and do something, then no one in the art establishment wants to touch them. I think that's what's happened to my medium over the last few decades. And that's fine. There'll be other mediums will arise up from the dirt of the streets and provide what true art can provide.
Meanwhile, we have The Bund, A Graphic History of Jewish Labor Resistance. I've been talking with Sharon Rudall. This is Norm Diamond. Thanks for joining us, Sharon.
Thank you for having me, Norm. It was fun.
With that vision of diverse peoples living in harmony, we turn to Bookmole, Larry Bolden's review of James McBride's 2023 novel, The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, depicting the love and cooperation between poor Jews and poor blacks in a small Pennsylvania town. Patricia will read Larry's review.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and today I'm reading a book review for Larry Bolden. Moshe Ludlow, a Romanian-born theater owner, opens a small town's first integrated dance hall. His wife, Chona, runs the Heaven and Earth grocery store on Chicken Hill, which caters to blacks and European immigrants, mostly Jewish. Chona is generous and warm-hearted, and though the store makes little profit, she is loved by all the residents of Chicken Hill. All of this wonderful novel by James McBride, entitled The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, is devoted to the description of the lives of the poor and discarded residents of Chicken Hill. Chona extends credit to the residents in spite of knowing she is unlikely ever to be paid. McBride, as a novelist, is able to describe the racism and anti-Semitism of the white community in ways neither journalists nor anthropologists could. While in many ways the residents of Chicken Hill struggle to survive at the margins of white Christian America, McBride's story is full of humor and warmth. Quote, "Who cared that life was lonely? That jobs were thankless drudgery, that the romance of the proud American state was myth, that the rules of life were laid carefully in neat books and laws written by stern Europeans who stalked the town and state like the grim reaper, with their righteous churches spouting that Jews murdered their precious Jesus Christ. Their fellow Pennsylvanians knew nothing about the shattered shtetls and destroyed synagogues of the old country. They had not set eyes on the stunned elderly immigrants starving in tenements of New York, the old ones who came alone, who spoke Yiddish only, whose children died or left them to live in charity homes, the women frightened until the end, the men consigned to a life of selling vegetables and fruits on horse-drawn carts. They were a lost nation spread across American countryside, bewildered, their yeshiva education useless, their proud history ignored as the clankety-clank of American industry churned around them, their proud past as watchmakers and tailors, scholars and historians, musicians and artists, gone, wasted. Americans cared about money and power and government. Jews had none of these things. Their job was to tread lightly in the land of milk and honey and be thankful that they were free to walk the land without getting their duffs kicked or worse. Life in America was hard, but it was free. And if you worked hard, you might gain some opportunity, maybe even a shop or business of some kind. End quote. While much of this novel is social criticism, there is much joy in McBride's description of music and dance in the daily lives of the poor on Chicken Hill. Most of McBride's prose in this and his other novels is wild and fantastical and full of warmth. Chona takes it upon herself to watch over the life of a deaf black child, and when the state comes looking for him, claiming he needs to be institutionalized, Chona's black neighbors help her to hide him away. The boy is eventually caught and sent to an insane asylum called Pennhurst. Many of the workers at the so-called hospital are black folks from a nearby community. They are called the Logods. Quote, "We is in the same place, you and I, being colored. We are visitors here. Thing is, us Logods, wherever we is from, the old Africa land, I suppose, we were keepers of our fellow man. That was our purpose. We're still that way. That's all we know of our history. The one was moved from us before we were brung here. You know what Logod means in our language? Little parent." End quote. A local black worker named Nate Timblin, with the help of the Logods, is able, nearly miraculously, to spring the boy from Pennhurst. This is a wonderful, big-hearted novel by an incredible storyteller. McBride's writing is so unusual and non-sequential that some readers may find it difficult to follow his narrative, but the effort will be well rewarded. I have been talking about James McBride's 2023 novel, The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and this is Patricia Kohlberg reading today for Larry.
I can't resist one more plutocrat-related musical selection. Here, from Cabaret, well, let them tell you what the song's about.
Money makes a bird go round the bird, go round the bird. Money makes the world go round, the clinking, clanking sound of money, 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 money.
Finally, we look at the rich history of filmmaking in the Middle East, including a growing number of women filmmakers. Old Mole Jan Hocken, a filmmaker herself, talks with Professor Yasmin Hanoush about her current course at Portland State, War and Coloniality in Arab Cinema. The course includes film showings open to the public. Jan?
Welcome to KABU, Yasmin Hanoush.
Thanks for having me here, Janice.
Well, Professor Hanoush is on the faculty in the Department of World Languages and Literature at Portland State University, where she directs the Arabic program. She's an Iraqi writer of both fiction and nonfiction and author of a number of publications and translations, as well as teaching courses, including critical perspectives on the Middle East, oil cities, and the Arabic novel, The Arabian Nights, and among many others. So it's a pleasure to have you on the Old Mole Variety Hour today to talk about your course this term, War, Coloniality, and Arab Cinema. We'll be talking later about how listeners can see the films on the PSU campus on Thursday evenings this term. So let's start by having you lay out the key themes of the class, and including the people and places identified as Arab filmmakers.
Thank you. Thanks again for having me here, Janice. So as you mentioned, I direct the Arabic program. I'm also the only full-time faculty in the Arabic program, which poses a challenge. There are 22 Arab countries, and it's hard to do all of them justice in the few course offerings that we can make. So I try in most of my courses to cover as much geopolitical and cultural ground as I can possibly do, and without focusing on one individual country. So I try to tease out those themes that apply to the region as a whole. And in my culture and literature courses, I generally aim to help students decenter and deconstruct dominant narratives that circulate in the West about the Middle East and the Arab world. I do so by bringing in not only marginalized voices and perspectives that are often missing or misrepresented in dominant discourses, I also use these cultural artifacts and voices to reframe how the overarching identity narratives are presented to Western audiences and to underscore the mechanisms of misrepresentation. So, for example, students often come to our classes thinking that the central problems in the Arab world that they will learn about stem from religious intolerance, a clash of civilizations, or the oppression of women. In my courses, I try to help students situate these tropes within a larger discourse that places the enduring imperialist colonial projects and their neoliberal and neocolonial aftermaths as the starting point of understanding the modern Arab world.
So with Israel's war against Gaza and so much activism, as well as horror unfolding around Palestine, how do you think these films and the class itself provide ways of seeing this region and its people? You said some of what you try to do is critique conventional tropes, stereotypes, ways of looking from through the Western gaze, we might say. Mm-hmm. But how do you see these particular films as providing a form of cultural work, but also political work?
Uh-huh. Well, first, in order to situate this more in what is happening right now, there is a massive misinformation or disinformation campaign on the origins of the so-called conflict between Israel and Palestine, rather than the settler colonial history of those events. And oftentimes, this crucial hegemonic global context is missing from mainstream representations. And also, we look at this region only by zooming in into Israel and Palestine without understanding the interconnectedness of what goes on within nearby countries. And so in this course, as an example, all the films we watch in this class depict anti-colonial and post-colonial struggles and war resistance efforts from the perspective of the colonized populations and the victims of wars and the war's devastating aftermath. So the reason is that traditionally these perspectives are absent or secondary in the empire film genre that dominates major Anglo-American film industries. So what the films presented in this course have in common is that they talk back to the dominant views of Western films, namely the empire and the Western film genres that center the imperial and the colonial experiences of the colonizer and the settler, whether to glorify or to critique them. So in a sense, we're presenting a counter narrative to what the American audiences are more comfortable or familiar with. We start the course with two films from the national epic genre, The Lion of the Desert and The Chronicle of the Years of Embers. Both of these films are state-funded post-independence movies that were made with the intent to forge and solidify a new collective national identity for the Libyan and the Algerian people, respectively. The Lion of the Desert was made in 1981, monumental production, and it narrates the story of fascist Italy's occupation of Libya from 1911 to 1931 under Mussolini's rule. And right away, the students start to notice the parallels between the present context and history that was taking place 100 years ago. The same happens with the Algerian epic, The Chronicle of the Years of Embers, which chronicles events during the French colonial period, which lasted for about 130 years in Algeria from 1830 to 1962. And this film focuses more on the personal experience of peasants in Algeria and how they coped with the indirect impacts of colonial presence, like the shortage of water, the droughts the farmers had to deal with because the water was diverted to the lands of the French settlers in Algeria.
This is an example of how the daily lives of people, the intimate aspects of personal life and these stories connect with larger historical dynamics and historical stories.
Yes, exactly. And what the course brings to life is that these struggles are continuous and repetitive, and that the tropes repeat in many of those colonial contexts. And so rather than getting stuck in word quibbles about is this settler colonialism or is it not, is this genocide or is it not, we work comparatively to see what it looked like in recent history in other adjacent nation states. What is the hegemonic project like? What is the human cost of these occupations and these infringement of other Western interests in the region on the local populations?
You know, Edward Said wrote a classic book called Orientalism that took up some of this same problem of how the Middle East is understood through the fetishizing gaze of Western eyes. And it sounds like some of the choices you've made of films and the film projects themselves kind of speak back to that notion of the Western Oriental gaze.
Yes, pretty much. Edward Said's theories in his in his masterpiece book Orientalism, and also his other masterpiece Culture and Empire, speak about the cultural products that accompany the making of empire. And the movie industry is kind of like an extension of that. It's the aftermath of the Western novel perpetuating or legitimizing the colonial project. And so yeah, pretty much everything we do is informed indirectly or indirectly by what Edward Said has contributed to the field. You are right to point out his contributions. And so from the state-sponsored epic movies, we move into something very different in genre, in tenor. This is a movie that was supposed to screen this week, but unfortunately the Manassa Center is closed due to damage from the ice storm. The movie is Silences of the Palace, which is a Tunisian melodrama that was made by Tunisian women director Mufida Tletli. And this movie looks at the impact of colonialism specifically on the lives of women and what the post-independence experience for women in Tunisia has been like.
Can you say a bit about women directors who, as I understand it, in Arab cinema have emerged in recent decades as a presence in what is, like many areas of filmmaking, primarily a male field of filmmakers and film production? What do you think this director brings as a lens on the lives of women, in addition to focusing on women and the untold stories of women?
Mm-hmm. So a little context about Tunisia. Although Tunisia is the smallest of the cinemas of the Maghreb, of, you know, Arab North Africa, it's nonetheless, it has the largest number of women directors. And the reason is that the 1956 post-independence state law gave Tunisian women social status unprecedented in any other Arab or Muslim country. What is remarkable about these Tunisian films that were made by women film directors is that while recognizing the difficulties women face in the Arab world, they refuse to turn their protagonists into passive recipients of patriarchal violence. Instead, a movie like Silences of the Palace and other movies situate these social cruelties within their broader, more encompassing colonial and post-colonial frameworks of societal oppression. And so by doing so, they help us understand the intersections between sexism, racism, state-sanctioned violence, and the legacy of colonialism.
It sounds like focusing on the agency of women as well.
Yes, very much so. Tlaiti, in her own language, described her female protagonists as colonized by the colonized. So she creates a bigger context for their struggle for liberation. They are not only struggling to liberate themselves from the world of patriarchy and men, but also those men who are oppressing them are themselves victims of another system of oppression, namely colonialism.
Yeah, that notion of struggling with patriarchies within as well as patriarchies imposed by the Western powers is, I'm sure, an important theme among women directors there, as it is in other places in the world.
For sure.
So there's also a film set in your own home country of Iraq that tells a very different story, as I understand. I haven't seen the film, but I've read about it, Son of Babylon, that is set after the fall of Saddam Hussein, about a young boy and his relationship, I think, with his grandmother, which sounds like it has a theme around the role of women in men's lives. Can you say a little about that film and whether you feel a particular affinity with Son of Babylon as an Iraqi scholar?
It's the film whose cultural and artistic terrain and also geographical terrain are most familiar to me, having grown up in Iraq. I was born and raised there, and I spent the first 17 years of my life in Iraq. And the story is mostly told from the perspective of the child, so it's very endearing and also very human and reminiscent of my own recollection of Iraq as a child and adolescent. And this movie was released in 2010. And it's, as you mentioned, it characterizes the relationship between a grandmother and her grandchild. And what's heartbreaking about that story is that they're the only two remaining members of that family. And the plot line itself is a search. It's an aftermath. It's post-war odyssey in search of the father of the son, who's the son of the grandmother, after they heard that prisoners of war have been released. So the time setting for this movie is outset of the fall of Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime in 2003 and the invasion of the U.S. Led powers in Iraq. And the country, the landscape, the backdrop to this story in the movie is complete chaos being unleashed throughout Iraq as the grandmother and her child travel in search of a son who had served in the military. And as they search for the son, father, they encounter other Iraqis who tell their stories of hardship. And then they learn about other very difficult events that took place during the reign of Saddam Hussein and the previous 30 years. Also, what's striking about this movie is that it initially starts out in northern Iraq. It moves all around the country. And in so doing, it juxtaposes the experience of a Kurdish people, a Kurdish grandmother and her child, to other Iraqis. So rather than representing Iraqis as one national or ethno-religious monolith, it brings out indirectly the diversity, the ethnic and religious diversity of the country. And there are some striking scenes where they talk to each other and acknowledge the atrocities that the Iraqi government committed against its own Kurdish people in the north. So yes, highly recommended. It's also the movie that will be screening next week. So I hope some folks will be able to.
Yes, I look forward to that. Can you say a little about the translation? I assume all these films are in Arabic and have subtitles translating for the audiences, non-Arabic speaking people. Is that something that, as a translator yourself, that you've been attuned to some of the challenges in, particularly the subtleties and the beautiful nuances of Arabic and how well they translate to the very limited amount of words often that are, that people are able to read in subtitling. Can you say a bit about that?
Yes, most of these movies are in Arabic and or the colonial language of that country, or a mix of the two. And there is a considerable loss in translation, as is often the case, but especially with Arabic, since the registers of the different vernaculars are so different. So, you know, everybody's speaking in their regional dialect. But you only get one version of English in the subtitles. Also, the quality of the subtitles varies from a movie to movie, from movie industry to movie industry, from time period to time period. Some of these movies were banned or not distributed in the U.S., so the quality of their English subtitles are leave more to be desired.
I bet that grates on you at times as a translator.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I have not personally contributed to the translation of the subtitles yet. I do think of it as a nice project to do with my language students.
I can imagine. Yeah, there's work to be done there.
Yes.
And I want to, before concluding, talk about the Tunisian director, Kawther Benhania, who's from Tunisia, and actually she's showing her more recent film at the Cascade Festival of African Films at Portland Community Colleges in early March. So you've chosen her recent film, The Man Who Sold His Skin, which seems beautifully produced, riveting, and heartbreaking. Can you say a little about that film and her vision as, sounds like she's, in a sense, a feminist filmmaker and also has a broad anti-colonial kind of lens on her subjects.
Yeah, this film was very striking. It was very different. When I watched it for the first time, it stood out as being distinct from most of the other movies I have seen on these topics that I teach in this class. It's an internationally co-produced drama, as you mentioned, by Tunisian women director Kawther Benhania. And it was nominated for the Best International Feature Film in 2021. And it tells the story of a Syrian of Syrian refugees during the Syrian civil war that had started in 2011. And the hard choices they have to make in order to survive their hardships. And although the main protagonist is male, there's a very strong female character there as well, the woman he's in love with and tries to pursue later on in Europe. But the story revolves on some more abstract themes that are very thought-provoking. Basically, the story is that the Syrian refugee agrees to get the Schengen visa tattooed on his back by one of the most controversial contemporary artists in the West. And his own body turns into a living work of art and promptly exhibited in museums. And then the film offers a caustic critique of the commodification of refugee bodies and the restrictions placed on their movements in the world.
It's a very different refugee story than the conventional ones of masses of refugees in boats that are sinking, which have their own power. But this is a very different approach to a refugee story.
Yes, a very different framing. It's about the relationship between art, commerce, and capitalism, and how these three conspire to undermine human dignity and human rights. So it zooms out of the scene into the bigger context of what refugees have to contend with globally.
So can you say a little bit about how you envision this class opening up to serve the community? And it's not very common in my experience that screenings of films and film classes are open to the community. Say a little bit about that and mm-hmm. how and where people can see the films and perhaps where they can find out if they want to go online, or can they just show up each Thursday and see what's happening?
So credit mostly goes to Mr. Ahmed Al-Mansouri, the director of the new Manassa Center.
Can you say what Manassa stands for?
Manasseh is the Middle East, North Africa, South Asia. It was an initiative with the goal of creating a cultural center to support the Manasseh student community at PSU. And they just inaugurated this new beautiful space in fall 2023. And this is why we're able to open up these screenings for free and to the public. So the public are welcome to come and watch these movies every Thursday at 4 p.m. The location is Smith Memorial Student Union, second floor, room 238. And the address is 1825 Southwest Broadway, Suite 238, Portland, Oregon.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for your important work.
And that's a wrap. Old Moles, Patricia Kohlberg, Fran Michel, Larry Bolden, and Jan Hocken contributed to today's program, as did guests Hyung Nam, Sharon Rudall, and Yasmin Hanush. Thanks to all, and to the supportive and dedicated KBOO staff. This is Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll return next Monday morning with our political and cultural focus, and go out now with a bit more of the Beatles. As for you, mask up, stay safe, and stay active.
Your loving give me a thrill, but your loving don't pay my bills. Now give me more.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, tech house, techno, German bass, breakbeats, future bass, downtempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
KBOO Community Radio is